Oil is where it's at. The latest Middle East war has again highlighted the importance of that vital commodity found under the barren desert sands of the Middle East. Oil. Not only is oil precious as the lifeblood of industrialized nations, but for the first time, oil has been used as a geopolitical weapon by the Arab nations. To Japan, Europe, and the United States, it must have been something like a fire in the bank where your life savings is kept. Because up to 90% of their life's blood comes from these oil areas of the Middle East. And now, for the fourth time since 1948, world attention again riveted on the Middle East in conflict. Eastern conflict is not just a war between tiny neighbors who can't resolve their political, ethnic, racial, and religious difficulties. It is of major concern to the big powers of the world, the presently recognized powers and the emerging ones, and not just the United States, already experiencing drastic measures, some not drastic enough, so say some of the leading senators in the American Congress, who are advocating the printing right now of wartime-type gas rationing books. Well, the president's speech is all a matter of past now and instant analysis, and all the callings for reductions in speed limits, for quotas or reductions on fuels, for public buildings, for daylight savings time, for the cutback in the uses of energy in the United States directly relates to the latest Middle Eastern conflict. Of course, it was all the more protracted because of an energy crisis in the former few months prior to the Israeli and the Arab outbreak over there. But it's not just the United States that is experiencing a part of the crunch, but the big powers of the world, Japan, Europe, yes, and to some large extent, other countries that people hardly ever even seem to notice, who also depend upon Eastern oil or Middle Eastern oil for their life's blood. The major concern is geographical and strategic. It's also geopolitical in terms of oil used as a political weapon, as well as religious. And Bible prophecy, believe it or not, has a great deal to say about the Middle East. The Bible is a book that is written from the Middle East point of view, geographically, ethnically, religiously, and in every other point of view. It's a Middle Eastern book, you might say. It does mention nations such as Egypt and Libya, Ethiopia, the nation of Israel today, under different names, of course, back then, the nations of those very peoples that make up Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Kuwait, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, are identified in the pages of the Bible. And the precious things of those countries that lie beneath their soil are identified in biblical prophecies mentioned over and over again in the Old as well as the New Testament. Now, for the purposes of this short series of programs, which we have used to actually interrupt our other regular series of programs, we want to look into the geopolitical, the geographical, and the strategic importance of the Middle East as viewed by the Soviet Union, by Europe, and by Japan. First, the Soviet Union. With the recent ascendancy of the Soviet naval fleet to number one in the world, with their clear-cut dominance of the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea, the Red Sea, and the all-important Gulf of Oman, gateway to the oil-rich Persian Gulf, any control of the tricontinental bridge that connects the land masses of Europe, Africa, and Asia, in addition to the Mediterranean naval force, could give the Soviets a hegemonial position in the Middle East. If the Soviets gained such a preponderant influence in the area, they could possibly bring pressure to bear on Israel's allies, principally the United States, and to a lessening extent, Europe, and allow the opening of the Suez Canal. Not a major consideration, but an important one. In this case, most of the world's vital sea lanes for trade and military purposes would come through the very area controlled, thus completing a Soviet ring around Asia and the Far East and parts of the Middle East. The more the Soviets have freedom of movement in these strategic areas, the more constricted in the movement, or is the movement rather, of other nations, and during a crisis, a trade war, or one involving oil, the Soviets would very likely be sitting in the driver's seat. Perhaps surprisingly, the existence of Israel has actually helped the Soviets to approach their present position of power in the Mediterranean and the Middle East, and their continuing effort as a kind of a patron of the Arab countries. Americans, especially in gaining control over the traditionally important tri-continental bridge. These modern Soviet naval vessels in the Mediterranean are far more up-to-date and sophisticated than any possessed by the American Navy. The American Navy is much older than the Soviet forces in the Mediterranean and growing increasingly smaller in comparative representation. They're saying that America still has somewhat of a tactical superiority because of certain missiles and the like, but the Soviet Navy is much larger, and especially in the field of submarines, they have the United States at a very incredible margin of superiority. I was asked when I interviewed Moshe Kol, who was Minister for Information of the Israeli cabinet member, I was asking him whether he believed it was fair to say that Russia needed the existence of Israel or the excuse of the existence of Israel in order to gain influence in the Arab world.
Well, I would not say that Russia needed in Israel. You know that Russia supported the independence of Israel in 1947, together with the United States. They voted together for the existence of Israel. It was after the Holocaust. It was after the Second World War. It was after the tragedy that we lost 6 million Jews. And they wanted also to be rid from the British from here. So they supported the independence of Israel, and we remind them now also. They are not happy that we are reminding it, because they would like to forget it today, because the Arabs don't like this action taken by the Soviet Union, but this is an historic fact. But I would say that they are using, to some extent, the independence of Israel to infiltrate more into the Arab countries.
And the Arab leadership is somewhat aware of this, at least. Certainly the Egyptian government has given evidence of that in their earlier ouster of some of the Soviet technicians and military aides in the country. But once again, we see the incursion or intrusion of the Soviet influence into the Middle Eastern area directly in proportion to the involvement of the Arabs in the latest conflict with Israel. And the resupply of the Arabian forces, Arab forces, I should say, of Syria and Egypt principally, has gone on, even though there was a brief interruption of it. Latest intelligence has it that the big Soviet airlift directly of supplies in form of ammunition, of missiles, of light tanks and the like, and 300 at least of the big heavy tanks has gone on apace. The United States, on the other hand, seems always to react rather than act in the van of a Middle Eastern crisis. Geographically, our interest is primarily Israel and the maintenance of her existence, and not geographically so much as ethnically and morally, if you wish to say, because of the fantastic numbers of the millions of Jews in the United States. I heard it said once, and I think it's true, that there are more Jews in the city of New York than there are in the entire nation of Israel. And of course, the intellectual community of the United States, all the way up to the president's advisors, the university professors, many people in commerce and industry, the entertainment industry certainly, many of these people are Jewish. It's natural, therefore, that the United States, with a very heavy Jewish population, would feel the way it does about the Israeli state. So you can't say geographically only our concern is there, but certainly we do not wish to see Soviet intrusion into the Middle East, one of the most critical hot spots in the history of the world, and destined to be one of the most critical for the foreseeable years to come. Now, the policy of the United States has been to try to maintain friendly relationships with all of them. Witness Jordan, for example. Jordan's King Hussein has been one of the most friendly of the Arab leaders toward the United States. So on the one hand, the United States has been supplying Jordanian armies with U.S. equipment. When the Jordanian soldiers began to fight against Israel on the Syrian front, they were using U.S.-made Patton tanks. The United States has supplied the Jordanian army. So on the one hand, the United States is supplying military arms to Israel. On the other hand, to Jordan, warring neighbors. The United States trying to walk the tightrope of good relations with both of them. Now, this policy is further complicated by the Soviet influence and support of the Arabs, including the latest technologically sophisticated weaponry, satellite intelligence and surveillance used for the first time in modern warfare, professional advisors, and the political support of the communist world. Thus, the United States does not want to alienate the Arabs, nor the Israelis, so it tends to react rather than act ahead of time. and is forced to take sides by the actions of the Soviet Union. And the latest Middle Eastern conflict has served to further blacken the eye of the Uncle Sam foreign policy in the Middle East in the sight of the Arabs. Why? Well, because first of our support of Israel, and without our help, of course, Israel may not even continue to exist. Even though American aid given to Israel served to maintain a certain balance in the Middle East, very often the balance seems to prolong the battle, and it simply means more of a heavy attrition and loss of life on the part of the Israelis, but the United States really feels conscience-stricken to do anything else. Aside from the importance of the state of Israel, the United States has an interest in counterbalancing the Soviet weight in the Middle East. And how should this best be done? Well, I ask the following question to Albert Sabin, who is president of the Weizmann Institute, and he answered, as you will hear. I asked him, what course, then, should the United States pursue in the Middle East to best serve its own, that's the United States, self-interests?
So I think to best serve her own national interests, the United States should do everything it can to prevent the further expansion of Soviet power through the Suez Canal into the Persian Gulf, into Africa, as I said before. I think that a stand should be made here without requiring a single soldier or person, as the United States has still 25 years after the war, more than 250,000 people in Europe where there's no danger, all the people in Asia where there's no danger. Not a single soldier is required here. If the United States makes it clear to the Soviet Union that by warlike measures and the policy that it is following of building up its strength in this area, it will not get domination of the world. Because if it does get through the Suez Canal, it will have domination of the world and leave to the United States maneuverability limited to the ultimate weapon, which is mutual suicide rather than an instrument for political orientation and influencing solutions for world problems.
So Professor Sabin feels that if Russia dominates the Suez Canal and that tricontinental bridge, that she is going to ultimately dominate the world. Well, I imagine Western planners in the United States, as well as in London and Bonn and perhaps in Paris, may feel the same thing. The Europeans cannot be left out. The soft underbelly of Europe, the entire strategic importance of the Middle East vis-a-vis Europe, an emerging superpower of these days, and Japan, is viewed in this map where we emphasize the trade routes, the sea lanes of that whole part of the world. You see there the flowing from the areas up past the Kamchatka Peninsula and in Japan itself, down north of the Philippines, following along past the island of Borneo and Java, through the Straits of Malacca, past the tip of Singapore, over past Colombo and Ceylon, and on up into the Middle East. You see the Persian Gulf lines there, one that goes right through the Suez Canal, but mainly the one that circumnavigates Africa and goes on up into Europe in the port of Europort or of Rotterdam, and of course into Britain. So Europe's interest is linked to the Middle East, as is the Soviet interest. And Soviet buildup in the Middle East and in the Mediterranean is viewed as being far more critical by the European powers and even perhaps immediately of concern to the United States. Europeans would like the Arabs to know that there is an alternative to total reliance on Russia, namely Europe. And you see, long ago, I was asking leaders in Europe, did they think there would ever come a time when there would be multilateral European intervention in the Middle East for the guarantee of the territorial integrity of the nation of Israel, or perhaps the internationalization of the city of Jerusalem and the protection of its holy places to the three major religions of the world? And in short, I was asking this question in the context of a multilateral European intervention outside the confines of NATO, not within any UN resolution. Resolution 242 that has been hammered upon by the Arabs, by the Soviet Union, and others who have continually called for the enactment of that resolution or the obedience to it by the Israelis, which really called for a withdrawal to the lines of the pre-1967 Six-Day War. So Europe, very, very heavily concerned in this area and wanting the Arabs to know that European reliance is also an alternative to this continual struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union. In Europe's desire to be a friend, the Arab nations is the converse of the same. To be less friendly with Israel and therefore the United States of America. A problem for Europe is the American quasi-isolationist feeling to bring the troops home. After all, why should we defend Europe if they don't help us defend Israel, we might say. Thus, Europe finds herself in a vice at the moment. kind of stuck between the United States trade as an ally of Israel and the close proximity to the Middle East, and the need to counterbalance a Soviet Union influence there, as well as the all-important consideration of Arab oil. Meanwhile, Japan, another major power really concerned with this area. In a moment, I come back and we'll talk about the Japanese influence in the Middle East and their concern about this almost immediate 25% cutback in Arabian oil.
The last Apollo flight lands on the moon while religious war rages in Northern Ireland. Politicians search for peace while pollution engulfs our planet. The gross national product of the United States exceeds $1 trillion while some 15,000 starve to death worldwide every day. In this age of paradox unparalleled, where can you turn for understanding? There is a source that answers the frightening questions of the 20th century. It's called The Plain Truth. This magazine of understanding reveals the meaning behind today's world news and shows you the good news beyond. The Plain Truth is full color, 52 pages, totally free of charge in the public interest. Today, more than ever before, you need The Plain Truth. For a free subscription, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
Don't write off Japan as being less than one of the major powers on the face of this earth today and a future military power of gigantic proportions. I believe she will become so. And I believe some of these happenings right now in the Middle East may be absolutely catalytic to the beginning whistle for individual nations, notwithstanding the arms limitations talks and the seeking for a discontinuation of nuclear testing, that such nations as Japan and West Germany and other European powers may also begin, even if it is a non-nuclear force, to build up, in the beginning, large conventional armies and navies. And this is the climate of the times in which we live. You see, Japan is an island nation that has virtually no reserves, no raw materials of any kind to support the fantastic, dizzying heights of this new economic miracle of a modern, revitalized, reindustrialized Japan. Japanese influence on the strategic makeup of the Middle East is very minimal, very small, and this is part of the problem to Japan. Because while on the one hand, there's been a great deal of difficulty between the Japanese and the United States, the Japanese in Europe, and other buyers of Arab oil, because the Japanese have been willing to buy it country by country and piecemeal. And I remind you that there was a time when the Arabs, for a moment there, raised the price about $2 a barrel for the Japanese, and they went ahead and bought it at that price, which also caused Europeans and Americans to get very edgy about it because it seemed to set a precedent. Well, a precedent was set, and of course, even though everybody thought the Arab countries would be very reluctant to ever use oil as a geopolitical weapon, thought perhaps they didn't mean it was just a lot of Arab threat, now we see the reality of that has come true. But here's the point. Japan depends not only upon oil, but upon anything from tin and chrome to molybdenum or any other of the raw materials that come not only from the United States, but the far-off deserts of Chile, of Central and South America, of all of Africa. The Japanese have been going around this world trying to secure 99-year leases or actual purchases of property on everything from timber tracts to mining properties all over the world to gain a hold on the raw material supplies of the world, and they have had more foresight in doing so than practically any other country. The Japanese are beginning to hurt. When Arab oil is even partially cut off, the Japanese are going to be concerned about it. At the present time, it seems there is almost minimal concern in the Western press with Japanese reaction over cutbacks in Arabian oil. But you will see a continuing concern and a greater interest, and I believe a reaction in the form of even military buildups in that part of the world as well, because oil has now become a geopolitical weapon. So the Middle East is like a chessboard on which the West plays a game against the East. The queens are the USSR and the USA. Europe, Japan, China, and the Arab nations would be the lesser pieces. Each side is trying for a checkmate. Each side trying to get the king. And what is the king? Oil. The Middle East represents at least 60% of the world's total proven oil reserves, and the distance from Jerusalem to the Soviet Union is only about 800 miles. Although the Soviet Union might not need the oil for herself immediately, control of it would give her control of the industrialized nations of the world and hence world domination. In short, the Soviet Union appears to be out to exploit the differences between the oil-producing countries and the United States, Europe, and Japan. The Russian press points out that Middle East oil production is still controlled by what they call the oil monopolies of the imperialist powers. This in turn helps pay the balance of payments deficit of the West, and the United States is exploiting, they say, the Arabs, and uses the State of Israel to maintain its position in the Middle East. The Soviet Union then urges the oil-producing countries to nationalize the West's oil companies, following the example, by the way, of Iraq. In about June of 1973, nationalization is a polite term for stealing the investments of other countries in the industries of foreign countries abroad. And while we may not realize it, the Japanese have also been investing heavily in large American corporations as well as American mining claims and timber tracts and even cattle raising projects and the like by buying some of the large Western ranches in the United States. The Japanese own a fair slice of real estate in this country now. So the Arabs complain that the West is greedily exploiting Arab oil. At the same time, Mother Russia supplies arms, technicians, and usually stands back with binoculars and directs in actual battle the Arab forces. But no one seems to be accusing very much the Russians of doing what they accuse others of doing in the Middle East. The Soviet Union promises aid and technical assistance to those countries which nationalize foreign oil industries, thus encouraging more of the Arab oil countries to do precisely that. And what does the Soviet Union gain? What do they want in return? More than oil from the Middle East, or even development of oil industry on their own soil, really. It's an opportunity to gain a much stronger foothold in the Middle East, and especially the environs of the Suez Canal. While not as important today as it once was, it becomes more and more important as we go along. I believe if the Russians did gain total influence there, they would deepen and widen it, and very likely it would eventually accommodate even the big Japanese super tankers. That may not be necessary. Simply by the pipelines that bypass it. And there are such, and by the way, the Soviet Union in its Eastern European satellites is already beginning to supply oil in the form of pipelines for natural gas to West Germany flowing from as far away as Poland. So on the other hand, as an ally of the Arab states, the Soviets can exert heavy influence on oil exporting and what Western nation gets what, thus gaining a geopolitical lever for other spots in the world, such as American troop withdrawal from Europe, limited cooperation and movement toward unity by the United Europe, European Union, whatever it might be called, in exchange for open lines of oil. What about the United States? Well, we know how important Arabian oil is for us, especially in the light of current fuel shortages. We thought maybe it was about 6%. Then came the presidential speech and remarks, and a lot of people began to wake up to the fact that we were depending upon European countries, notably the Netherlands, for refined petrochemical and oil products, and that the cutback of the Arabian oil meant more than just shortage of gasoline and jet fuel, but shortages in a lot of other areas as well. What about vinyl? In the automotive manufacturing concern, for example, in the plastics industry and many others. But the United States gets less than 10% of her present oil from the Middle East, but perhaps more importantly, a full 50% of the heating fuel for the East Coast of the United States comes from the Middle East presently, and this will probably go up as overall dependence on Middle Eastern oil seems destined to grow. We should also remember that our foreign policy was not very accurate in gauging the intentions of the Arabs. And we can say what we will about Israeli intelligence and the fact that they were not ready. Well, neither were we ready. Not for the fuel crises or shortages, and not for what happened in the Middle East. Does that lead us to believe we will be better prepared for other emergencies that may come in the future? Try to buy raisins in the little boxes in the grocery stores these days, and what do you find? What about the citrus crop in Florida that was so very badly hurt by the winter of 1972? Did anyone really suspect that there would be a terrible shortage of citrus fruit the next few months into the summer? No, not very much. What about food grain shortages and the shipment of massive bushels of wheat to Russia and to China and to India and other countries? And what about the fuel shortage and how it affects some of the granaries themselves? For example, the loss of millions of bushels of soybeans recently just because of a natural gas or of a heating oil shortage, which caused a granary to shut down the heating, which simply means that the grain is going to mildew and finally rot. Europe, though, is a major area of concern in the Middle East. The dilemma that they face is one of the most serious in post-war history. And here we have a world where just prior to this Middle Eastern conflict, we saw the toppling of one government after another, the emergence of a military dictatorship virtually in Greece, the violent overthrow of a government in Chile, the threatened overthrow of governments all around the world, the continuing warfare that is going on in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, and now another breakout of hostilities, a big shooting war involving thousands, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, thousands of tanks, hundreds of aircraft in the Middle East, right at the very nerve center of so much of the rest of the world, and especially Europe. Now, all of this cutback can mean a lot of things to Europe. It can mean full-scale depression. It can mean widespread joblessness, of course, immediately. And it likely is going to mean precisely that. And I tell you, as I've told our listeners and our viewers on television, our listeners on radio, and the readers of the Plain Truth magazine for the many, many years of this program, that any terrible shift in the climate, the domestic climate of those European peoples who have been enjoying an unparalleled prosperity since World War II, the miraculous buildup of a united Europe and the move toward full political integration, any terrible crash over there in terms of a massive depression could lead toward the shifting of the subventions from industrialists of political support into very unsavory quarters. Those people don't always react the way we do in the United States, and I'm here to tell you that democracy is only about skin deep inside Western Europe, and especially in West Germany. Things could begin to shape up that you simply would not believe. I have said publicly for many years that the time would come very soon now, and I was saying this in the very heyday, you might say, of the terrible agonies in the United States, the university disruptions, the giant riots, all of the attacks by various people against government over Vietnam, right in the midst of the worst agonies of Vietnam. I was saying the time is going to come when the Middle East and Europe is going to pale into insignificance. Your concern in the headlines, what you hear coming from there, is going to pale into insignificance, your concern even now over Vietnam. Well, it's happening. Why did I say that? Well, because about a third of the Bible is prophecy. And because Bible prophecy zeroes in on the Middle East, there is no other part of the world with which Jesus Christ was more personally concerned than that area. And one major prophecy he holds up for us to take a look at today is the one in which he said in Matthew 24, Luke 21, Mark 15, where he said, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh." And he talked about a time which would be a great tribulation such as had never occurred from the beginning of the world to that time. Are we living in the time just prior to the fulfillment of about 90% of Bible prophecy? I believe we are. If you have your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine, you will see what is happening in world conditions in the light of Bible prophecy. This Middle Eastern conflict will appear in the form of a special edition of the Plain Truth magazine very quickly. If you get your name in right now, you'll be sure to receive it. It's free of charge and no price, 52 pages, full color. A Middle East special from the Plain Truth magazine. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, BC.